Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens. Among other public buildings in a certain town, which for many reasons it will be prudent to refrain from mentioning, and to which I will assign no fictitious name, there is one anciently common to most towns, great or small, to wit, a workhouse. And in this workhouse was born the item of mortality called Oliver Twist. After a few struggles, Oliver gave the first proof of the free and proper action of his lungs. A faint voice imperfectly articulated the words, "Let me see the child and die." The surgeon said with more kindness than might have been expected of him, "Oh, you must not talk about dying yet."
"Lord bless her dear heart, no," interrupted the old nurse. "When she has lived as long as I have, sir, and had 13 children of her own, and all of them dead except two, and them in the workhouse with me, she'll know better than to take on in that way. Bless her dear heart. Think what it is to be a mother. There's a dear young lamb, do."
Apparently this consolatory perspective of a mother's prospects failed in producing its due effect. The patient shook her head and stretched out her hand towards the child. The surgeon deposited it in her arms. She imprinted her cold white lips passionately on its forehead, passed her hands over her face, gazed wildly round, shuddered, fell back, and died. The surgeon leaned over the body and raised the left hand. "The old story," he said. "No wedding ring, I see." Oliver cried lustily. If he could have known that he was an orphan left to the tender mercies of church wardens and overseers, perhaps he would have cried the louder. Oliver Twist's 9th birthday found him keeping it in one of the branch workhouses, some 3 miles off, in the coal cellar, with a select party of 2 other young gentlemen who, after participating with him in a sound thrashing, had been locked up therein for atrociously presuming to be hungry, when Mrs. Mann, the good lady of the house, was unexpectedly startled by the apparition of Mr. Bumble, the beadle. Mrs. Mann ushered the beadle into a small parlour, placed a seat for him, and officiously deposited his cocked hat and cane on the table before him.
"Now, will you take a little drop of something, Mr. Bumble?"
said Mrs. Mann persuasively.
"Just a little drop?"
The beadle stirred the gin and water.
"I drink your health with cheerfulness, Mrs. Mann."
And he swallowed half of it.
"And now, about business," said the beadle. "The child, Oliver Twist, is 9 years old today."
"Bless him," interposed Mrs. Mann.
"Oliver being now too old to remain here, the board have determined to have him back into the workhouse. I've come out myself to take him there, so let me see him at once."
Oliver was led into the room by his benevolent protectress.
"Will you go along with me, Oliver?" said Mr. Bumble in a majestic voice.
"Will she go with me?" inquired poor Oliver.
"No, she can't," replied Mr. Bumble. "But she'll come and see you sometimes."
This was no very great consolation to the child. Young as he was, however, he had sense enough to make a feint of feeling great regret at going away. Hunger and ill usage are great assistants if you want to cry, and the little companions of misery he was leaving behind were the only friends he had ever known. The room in the workhouse in which the boys were fed was a large stone hall with a copper at one end, out of which the master, dressed in an apron for the purpose, ladled the gruel at mealtimes. Of this festive composition, each boy had 1 bowl, and no more. Boys generally have excellent appetites. Oliver Twist and his companions got so voracious and wild with hunger that one boy was afraid he might some night happen to eat the boy who slept next to him. A council was held. Lots were cast who should walk up to the master after supper that evening and ask for more, and it fell to Oliver Twist. The evening arrived. The gruel was served out. The gruel disappeared. Oliver rose from the table and advancing to the master, basin and spoon in hand, said, "Please, sir, I want some more." The master was a fat, healthy man, but he turned very pale. He gazed in stupefied astonishment on the small rebel for some seconds, and then clung for support to the copper.
"What?" said the master, in a faint voice. "Please, sir," replied Oliver, "I want some more."
The master aimed a blow at Oliver's head with the ladle and shrieked aloud for the beadle. Mr. Bumble rushed into the room in great excitement. Oliver was ordered into instant confinement. And next morning it was arranged that Oliver should go to Mr. Sowerberry, the parochial undertaker, upon liking, a phrase which means that if the master find, upon a short trial, that he can get enough work out of a boy without putting too much food into him, he shall have him for a term of years to do what he likes with. When little Oliver was informed that he was to go as general house lad to a coffin maker's, he evinced so little emotion that by common consent he was pronounced a hardened young rascal, and Mr. Bumble was ordered to remove him forthwith. The undertaker, who had just put up the shutters of his shop, was making entries of his day-book by the light of a dismal candle when Mr. Bumble entered.
"I've brought the boy, Mr. Sowerberry."
Oliver made a bow. The undertaker raised the candle above his head to get a better view of Oliver. Mrs. Sowerberry emerged from a little room behind the shop.
"My dear," said Mr. Sowerberry, "this is the boy from the workhouse that I told you of."
Oliver bowed again.
"Dear me," said the undertaker's wife. "He's very small."
"Why, he is rather small," replied Mr. Bumble, looking at Oliver. "There's no denying it. But he'll grow, Mrs. Sowerberry. He'll grow."
"Ah, I dare say he will," replied the lady pettishly, "on our victuals and our drink. There, get downstairs, little bag of bones."
With this, the undertaker's wife opened a side door and pushed Oliver down a steep flight of stairs into a stone cell, damp and dark, forming the anteroom to the coal cellar, and denominated the kitchen, where she ordered a slatternly girl to give him some cold bits that were put by for the dog. Oliver clutched at the dainty meats that the dog had neglected and tore the bits asunder with all the ferocity of famine. Oliver was awakened in the morning by a loud kicking at the outside of the shop door, which, before he could huddle on his clothes, was repeated in an angry and impetuous manner about 25 times.
"Open the door, will you?"
"I will directly, sir,"
replied Oliver, undoing the chain and turning the key. A big charity boy was sitting on a post in front of the house, eating a slice of bread and butter.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Oliver, at length, seeing that no other visitor made his appearance. "Did you knock?"
"You don't know who I am, I suppose, workus," said the boy.
"No, sir," rejoined Oliver.
"I'm Mr. Noah Claypole, and you're under me. Take down the shutters, you idle young ruffian."
Noah was a charity boy, but not a workhouse orphan. No chance child was he, for he could trace his genealogy all the way back to his parents, who lived hard by, his mother being a washerwoman and his father a drunken soldier. The month's trial over, Oliver was formally apprenticed. It was a nice, sickly season just at this time. In commercial phrase, coffins were looking up, and Oliver had acquired a great deal of experience. Noah Claypole used him far worse than before, now that his jealousy was aroused by seeing the new boy promoted to the black stick and hat band. One day Oliver and Noah had descended into the kitchen to banquet upon a pound and a half of the worst end of the neck, when Noah, being hungry and vicious, got rather personal.
"Workus," said Noah, "how's your mother?"
"She's dead," replied Oliver. "Don't say anything more to me about her. You better not."
"You know, workus, your mother was a regular right-down bad un."
"What did you say?" inquired Oliver, looking up very quickly.
"A regular right-down bad un, workus," replied Noah, coolly.
Crimson with fury, Oliver started up, overthrew the chair and table, seized Noah by the throat, shook him in the violence of his rage till his teeth chattered in his head, and collecting his whole force into one heavy blow, felled him to the ground.
Oh, he'll murder me," blubbered Noah. "Help, help!"
Mrs. Sowerberry plunged into the kitchen and held Oliver with one hand while she scratched his face with the other. In this favourable position of affairs, Noah rose from the ground and pommeled him behind. This was rather too violent exercise to last long. When they were all wearied out and could tear and beat no longer, they dragged Oliver, struggling and shouting, but nothing daunted, into the dust cellar, and there locked him up. This being done, Mrs. Sowerberry sunk into a chair and burst into tears.
"Oh, oh,"
said Mrs. Sowerberry, speaking as well as she could through a deficiency of breath.
"Oh, what a mercy we've not all been murdered in our beds. Noah, you poor fellow,"
and she looked piteously on the charity boy. Noah, whose top waistcoat button might have been somewhere on a level with the crown of Oliver's head, rubbed his eyes with the inside of his wrists while this commiseration was bestowed upon him, and performed some affecting tears and sniffs.
"What's to be done?" exclaimed Mrs. Sowerberry. "Your master's not at home. Run to Mr. Bumble, Noah, and tell him to come here directly and not to lose a minute. Never mind your cap. Make haste. You can hold a knife to that black eye as you run along, and it'll keep the swelling down."
Noah stopped to make no reply, but started off at his fullest speed, and very much it astonished the people who were out walking to see a charity boy tearing through the streets pell-mell with no cap on his head and a clasp-knife at his eye. Noah Claypole paused not once for breath until he reached the workhouse gate. Having rested here for a minute or so to collect a good burst of sobs and an imposing show of tears and terror, he knocked loudly at the wicket.
"Oh, Mr. Bumble, sir,"
said Noah.
"Oliver, sir. Oliver has..."
"What? What?"
interposed Mr. Bumble, with a gleam of pleasure in his metallic eyes.
"Not run away. He hasn't run away, has he, Noah?"
"Oh, no, sir. No. Not run away, sir. But he's turned vicious," replied Noah. "He tried to murder me, sir, and then he tried to murder Charlotte and then Mrs. Oh, what dreadful pain it is! Oh, such agony, please, sir!"
When Noah saw that the intelligence he communicated perfectly paralysed Mr. Bumble, he imparted additional effect thereunto by bewailing his dreadful wounds 10 times louder than before. Mr. Bumble and Noah Claypole betook themselves with all speed to the undertaker's shop. Here the position of affairs had not at all improved, as Sowerberry had not yet returned, and Oliver continued to kick with undiminished vigour at the cellar door. The accounts of his ferocity, as related by Mrs. Sowerberry, were of so startling a nature that Mr. Bumble judged it prudent to parley before opening the door. With this view, he gave a kick at the outside by way of prelude, and then, applying his mouth to the keyhole, said in a deep and impressive tone,
"Oliver."
"Come, you let me out," replied Oliver, from the inside.
"Do you know this here voice, Oliver?"
said Mr. Bumble.
"Yes," replied Oliver.
"Ain't you afraid of it, sir? Ain't you a-trembling while I speak, sir?"
said Mr. Bumble.
"No," replied Oliver boldly.
An answer so different from the one he had expected to elicit, and was in the habit of receiving, staggered Mr. Bumble not a little. He stepped back from the keyhole, drew himself up to his full height, and looked from one to another there of the bystanders in mute astonishment.
"Oh, you know, Mr. Bumble, he must be mad," said Mrs. Sowerberry. "No boy in half his senses could venture to speak so to you."
"It's not madness, mum,"
replied Mr. Bumble after a few moments of deep meditation.
"It's meat."
"What?"
exclaimed Mrs. Sowerberry.
"Meat, mum. Meat,"
replied Mr. Bumble with stern emphasis.
"You've overfed him, mum. You've raised a artificial soul and spirit in him, mum, unbecoming a person of his condition. What have paupers to do with soul or spirit? It's quite enough that we let them have live bodies. If you had kept the boy on gruel, mum, this would never have happened."
"Dear, dear,"
ejaculated Mrs. Sowerberry, piously raising her eyes to the kitchen ceiling.
"This comes of being liberal."
Sowerberry returned at this juncture. Oliver's offence having been explained to him, he at once gave him a drubbing and ordered him upstairs to his dismal bed.